It was my pleasure a couple of months ago to hear the gentleman's tape of his message along with my wife before we invited him to Founders Day. And I want to tell you, he's got a lot of great things to say to us, a message of hope, and I know that many of us need that. So without anything more for me, I'd like to introduce our speaker, Mr. Bob Olson from Denver.
Hi, everybody. My name's Bob Olson. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Bob.
Well, you do have enthusiasm. Whoa. You sound like my wife. Speak up, Bob. It's by the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've not found a need or an excuse to take a drink today, nor have I found a need or an excuse to take a drink since May 28th, 1973. I'd like to thank Linda and Dave for their hospitality and Peggy Ann. I'd like to thank you for inviting me here. I live quite a ways away from here. I live at the base of the Rocky Mountains. My home group is a Tuesday night step workshop at the Happy Way group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Englewood, Colorado. That might give you a little clue about what I'm going to talk about. I have to tell you in the beginning that I didn't fly halfway across the country to talk about drunk stories. The only one I'm going to tell you isn't even about me. I came here to talk about recovery. And I came... That's really the only message I have to share with you. The story I want to tell you is about someone I knew, a bad alcoholic. He'd been drinking alcoholically since he was about 20 years old. He was a stonemason in southern Wisconsin. He was married somewhere between 7 and 9 times. Women just loved him. God, they were just crazy about him until they got him home. About 15 years ago, he had a stroke. He had had some physical difficulties before that. I had went to look for him one time and found that he was living in a tar paper shack just outside of Savannah, Illinois. Had an old pickup and a dog. Living by himself, and came out there and found him one day dying of bleeding ulcers and put him in the hospital, and one of the nurse's aides took a shine to him and he married her. She died shortly after that of alcoholism. And not too long after that he had a stroke and they sent him to the Grand Army home in Wisconsin and they gave all of his assets to the state. When he had the stroke, he lost his ability to speak, and he was paralyzed and unable to walk or move one arm and spent the rest of his life in a wheelchair. He had had 2 children, a son and a daughter, and in the 15 years that he spent at the Grand Army home, hardly anyone ever came to see him. He had a brother that lived close. And sometimes his son or his daughter would come to see him, but basically he was pretty solitary. And about 2 years ago, because he had been in a wheelchair for so long and because he had adult onset diabetes, his extremities started to turn black. They went to his brother and they said, we're going to have to amputate one of his feet. And his brother gave them permission, and and they amputated his foot. Now, he was unable to speak. And pretty soon they came back to his brother and they said, we're going to have to take off the rest of his leg and his other foot. But you need to know that at some point he's going to die from gangrene. And the choice is, does he die now or should we just keep taking pieces off of him until there's nothing left to take? And it was his brother's decision that they let him die. And he knew it. And he couldn't talk about it. And in his despair, he would sit in his wheelchair and he would scream at anyone that came close to him. And he lived the four horsemen of alcoholism: terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And a year ago he died of gangrene. And he's buried in a little cemetery behind the hospital. And his name is Bob Olson. And he's my father. The point of that is twofold. One of them is he died like an alcoholic, and I had that choice too. And people in my family have been dying like that ever since we got here from Norway. Generation after generation after generation. The other point is that I don't have to. And I'm the first member in my family that found Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's a real stretch to figure out that one of the alcoholic Olsons from Madison, Wisconsin would ever stand in front of this group. Thank you, God. Somebody told me that Alcoholics Anonymous was about two things. It was about God and it was about booze. And then I didn't have the power to keep myself sober, and God did, and I better spend the rest of my time trying to get as close to Him as I can. And the only way I knew how to do that were through 12 spiritual exercises that I learned in this program called the 12 Steps, and that's what I'm here to talk about. I'm here to talk about my experience with the 12 Steps. You know, it's kind of funny because you go someplace and you see Alcoholics Anonymous, looks like it's all fear and fellowship, and all you have to do is put the kind of message in front of them about the hope that's involved in those spiritual exercises. And you can polarize those groups and you can save lives. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in May of 1973, they sat me down in front of a priest in a halfway house. And he asked me a couple of questions. He said, "Are you done drinking?" And I was. You know, I'd been drinking a fifth a day for so long I couldn't even remember. I was so sick I thought I was going to die. He said, "Do you want what we have?" And I wanted anything anybody had except what I had, because what I had was a bad case of sick and tired. The book says we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we're like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. I had to find out if I was an alcoholic. You know, it wasn't hard in 1973 to know I was an alcoholic. I was damn near dead. I mean, I've been drinking so long and so hard that it didn't seem like there was anything left in my life but just drinking. Drinking took priority over everything. And I sat there and there was no doubt in my mind at that point in time, and it was the first time in years and years of drinking that I really knew. And I just wanted to not die. I just wanted to live one more day because maybe there was a little hope in that. And it looked like there were some people that had the same kind of problem I had and that they didn't have to drink anymore. And that gave me hope just looking at them. the book describes alcoholism. If when you want to, Sliano, you can't want to, you can't quit entirely. I couldn't quit entirely. Never could quit. Could quit for a little while. And rarely do that. Sometimes if there is enough money on it, I could quit for a few days. Or if when you start, you have little control over the amount you take. I never knew how much I was going to take. I was always going to have two drinks. Never could. Never could pull it off. It says in the book that at some point real alcoholics always lose control. Is that what's going on with me? You know, it's kind of interesting because I don't know how you feel about doing the steps because sometimes geographically it's different, but we do them over and over again. And when I take, when I go back through the steps today, and I'm right in the middle of inventory again, when I go back through the steps today, I have to go back and ask myself that question from an 18-year perspective. Am I really an alcoholic? I'll give you something that'll get you up in your chair a little bit. Are you willing to believe that you're not? I am. I have to look at it all over again. I mean, what if I don't believe it anymore? I'll drink. And if I drink, I'll die. And I don't want to die because you can't imagine how good my life is today. I want some more of this. I truly do. You can imagine how good my life is today. So I have to ask myself that, am I really an alcoholic? In the book it talks about social drinkers, and I don't even know what the hell that is. It talks about a certain kind of heavy drinker. Now that person may wind up in a treatment center or a hospital or a court for divorce or traffic. He could wind up anywhere the drunks wind up. But if there's sufficient reason, he can stop. That means if a doctor comes up and says, you're going to die if you keep drinking, he'll stop. Or the spouse will come up and say, you're out of here if you don't stop, and they stop. And I couldn't stop. I remember my wife saying, Bob, we don't have any food, and everybody's hungry. We got to get some food. It's just like two bottles of booze. And I couldn't do it. Tommy's going to school, and he doesn't have any clothes, and he needs shoes. And it's just a couple of bottles of booze. Everything in my house was equated with bottles of booze. It's just a couple bottles of booze. I can't help it. I'm not trying to be a jerk. I got to drink. And I drink. To the exclusion of everyone. My wife, my children, my parents. I would drink in spite of anything. I'm a real alcoholic. When I sat in front of that priest, he asked me a question, do you believe in God? And I told him no. And he said, then I suggest you go find one. And I said, I wouldn't even know where to start. And he said, well, didn't you ever learn anything and you ever go to church? And I said, yeah, I did when I was a kid. And he said, well, figure out a God you like. And I said, okay. And he said, go home and think about it. I went home and I thought about it, and I remembered that I had grown up with four or five different families when I was a kid and that I never had a father, and I thought him being a father was a heck of a good idea. And I started thinking about that, and I thought, you know, if he was gentle instead of like my dad on the few occasions when I saw him, and when I rarely saw him, he was usually trying to beat me up. And I thought if I had a father and he was gentle, maybe that would make sense. And that's all I figured out. And I went back to this priest and I said, he said, did you find a God? And I said, well, I know what I'd like God to be. And he said, what's that? And I said, a father and gentle. And he said, well, that's exactly what I think God is. And that's exactly what he is. The book says if we're even willing to believe upon this simple structure, or simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. If we're even willing to believe. You know, I didn't know God was there. I was just hoping He was there. And I decided to try and believe. And my life changed. It says, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we could neither postpone nor evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that God either is or He isn't. He's either everything or He's nothing. What's your decision to be? My self-imposed crisis isn't just my alcoholism. My self-imposed crisis is that I can't fix myself. I'm dying from this and I can't stop. And you can't fix me. No human power can relieve my alcoholism. You can't and I can't. Who can? Well, there better be a God. Or I'm SOL. You know, I believe that God is. And I believe He's everything. Everything in this program is an act of faith. Everything. There's no reward on the front end. It's really kind of interesting. If you watch people in Alcoholics Anonymous, well, I'll mention this to you. In my observation, in Alcoholics Anonymous, likes attract. That means all the BSers hang out with the BSers. All right? And all the people who want to recover hang around with the people who want to recover. Who are you hanging out with? And what did you do to help the man who still suffers today? From a perspective of 18 years, you know, I can go back, and just because you're sober doesn't mean you're well. And so I get into these things. I'd go sliding right into untreated alcoholism. And you go back in the second step, I'll tell you, some of the best stuff in the book is right in there. And you look in the book there, and it starts talking about people that are making heavy going out of life. And it talks about people who are having difficulty with relationships and people who can't seem to be of real service to others, people who are prey to misery and depression, people who are having trouble finding a job. And that was going on with me. And I went in there and I thought, well, what's the answer to that? Because that book comes with the answers too. And I looked at it and it was talking about power. You know, in the beginning, and almost everybody knows that that book says lack of power. Lack of power is the problem. Well, how are we supposed to find it? That's what the book is about, finding a power greater than ourselves. And it talks about becoming willing to believe. Now, I have this dilemma about lack of power. And all of a sudden, I become willing to believe, and it says there's new power flowing in. And then all of a sudden it talks about people who have power, peace, happiness, and a sense of direction in their lives. And it says that that the difference between those people and the people who are making heavy going out of life is that God is the central fact in their lives. And see, power, peace, happiness, and a sense of direction is all that I've ever wanted. That's everything. It's all I want out of life. I moved to Denver in 1974, right in front of the 1975 International, and I ran into all these people who were these real book thumpers, and they started coming after me, and I had never really done much, and I kind of knew I was going to drink again, and they said there is a solution, and it works for everybody. Even somebody as burnt out and blown away as you are can recover using the 12 steps. So you better get busy, and we'll show you how to do it. And I sat down with my sponsor and started at the forward of the first edition where it says in italics, to show others precisely how we have recovered is the purpose of this book. Sometimes it sounds kind of tacky to walk up to somebody and say, I can show you precisely how to recover. But it's true. Because my sponsor showed me precisely how to recover, and all I had to do was follow the directions. When we got to the third step, he talked to me about alcoholism, the disease. And he said, you know, bottles are only the symptom of this. Bob, you think alcoholism is putting a bottle to your mouth and draining all the liquid out of it. And he said, it isn't. It's about selfishness and dishonesty and resentment and fear. And it's about being driven away from God. And he said, if you can get that in tow, if you can work on those four things, you don't have to drink anymore. In fact, you don't even have to want to drink anymore. And he said, you do that by finding God. And in here there's a decision, and the decision is in a prayer. And the prayer says, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help with thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. And he said, and that's the commitment. He said, selfishness is the base. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our disease. And it is. So he said, go home. Think about that. Tell me what you think. It's a commitment. You're going to have to turn your will and your life over to God, and that means all the way. He gets it all. He gets to do anything with you he wants. Anything. I don't want to give that guy, I don't want to give God that kind of power. And when I went back a week later, he said, are you willing to do it? And I was scared. And I said, yeah, I am. And I got on my knees and I held hands with him and I said the prayer. And the part about I offer myself to God so he can do anything with me that he wants is true, and I believed it. And I was willing to make the commitment. You know, being relieved of the bondage itself is an enormous gift, because all I could ever see was me. You know, I went pole vaulting over mouse turds more than anybody I think I ever met. I made such a big deal out of everything that was going on in my life because I thought I was so important, and I'm not. I'm just part of the herd. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help. That means take an old burned up drunk like me and clean me up and let people see that this really works. That if you have a dream in your life, it doesn't have to stay a dream, because God can do for us what we can't do for ourselves. And if you don't believe that, try it and see if it works. You know, we're kind of literalists where I go to meetings. And if the book says something, if we don't believe it, we test it. You want to try it sometime? Try this. There's a line in the book that says that we made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. Next time you get hurt, look back. See if you made a decision based on self, which put you there. Always worked for me. Good. Let me be an example that this really works. You know, I'm not a saint. I'm far from it. I'm not a particularly religious person, but I pray as much as anybody I know. God really works in my life and has for years. And I haven't wanted a drink since almost from the time that I came through the door. I made that decision, and at the end of that I thought, well, this is really good. You know, I got up and I felt this sense of relief and I felt a sense of power in my life. and I felt like something had really happened, and it had. And I, and my sponsor said, I want you to read something. And the part that he wanted me to read was the part that says this will have little permanent effect unless it's at once followed by a rigorous attempt to clean house. And he said, Bob, I don't know what that means to you, but to me it means it's going to wear off if you don't write inventory. Now, I was always hoping that there was some space where it said, okay, now that's been tough, so relax for about 3 or 4 months and get your wind, and then we'll just sort of run you into inventory. Let me share something with you about new people in the program. I see a lot of people go, that's okay, just get your feet under you. And they go in there and they stroke them, you know, and they go, you're just fine, and they love you back to life. And then they say, well, you just wait, you know, in about 6 months we'll get started on the steps, and then you can do that. I don't believe that. I don't believe in it. I think you're messing with people's lives. And that's an opinion, and that means you can just pssst. But I'll tell you what, the strongest statement in the book is, with all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. You know that stuff we heard this weekend about, when do I start doing the steps? And the answer was, when do you want to start getting well, is true. How long can you survive with your alcoholism intact? Well, I started writing an inventory. I really didn't come here to take issue with a whole lot of things. I did the inventory out of the book. I won't say any more than that. I'm always amazed by people who feel that they ought to take poetic license with an almost perfect spiritual program. Why, you know, people go, well, this is nice, but this is better. Right? Horse manure. It was good the way it started, and if we leave it alone, it'll be good for the next 5 generations of drunks. What is that? I wrote down all these resentments, people, institution, principles. I wrote down why I was mad at him in the second column, and I wrote down how that affected me, whether it was my self-esteem, my security, ambitions, personal sex relations, pocketbook. And then I had to go back and look at all of those. I had to find out in each one of those instances where I was selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. And that's where I found out what I was about. That's where I found out what the truth was about me. And I need to see that. You know, if I'm going to be an example, and if I work with someone today, and I work with a lot of people, if I work with them, I better know about me. Because the more I know about me, the more I know about you, because we're all the same. I finished my resentment inventory, and I figured that was about as much as I needed to do, and I went back to my sponsor and I said, I'm done. And he said, where's your fear inventory? And I said, what fear inventory? And he said, well, you need to write down everything you're afraid of. And I said, well, I'm not afraid of anything. You know my history. I was a bill collector on the north side of Chicago. What the hell am I afraid of? I mean, if I was afraid of anything, I would have been hauling ass out of one of those projects. He said, really? How about snakes? So what kind of snakes? And he said, well, how about rattlesnakes? And I said, well, I wouldn't want to be in a closet with one. And he said, well, write down snakes. How about spiders? Like black widows, you mean? Yeah, that's good. No, I don't like those either. Well, write down spiders. How about failure? Oh, cheap shot. Well, see, everybody always said I was going to be like my dad, and I guess I halfway believed him. How about inadequacy? Oof. Yeah, I just never thought I was good as anybody else. How about women? Oh, no. Really? You telling me you're not afraid of women? Well, I guess a little. Write down women. How about children? Just the little ones, because I don't like to hold them. I'm afraid I'm going to drop them. Write down infants. How about the police? Oh. Only when I see one right behind me. Write down police. How about the courts? Whew. I was sentenced to 2 years in the Green Bay Reformatory for assault when I was 17 years old and didn't think that the courts had been treating me too well. Write down the courts. How about homosexuality? Oh, come on. I don't know about that. I don't know what to do with that. And I don't want to be around that. Write down homosexuality. Is there anything you're not afraid of? I guess not. The book says that fear is an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence is shot through with it. It's true. Never met a drunk that wasn't terrified. With good reason. And the good news in that is that it says, wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Yes. Left to my own devices, do I have good reason to be afraid of all of that? Yeah, I really do. But if I am standing in the presence of God, do I have anything to fear? Not a thing. Not a thing. People go, don't you get nervous about getting up and talking? Not if you know what your intent is. I mean, if my intent is to get up here and to find somebody out there that still suffers and needs to know that Alcoholics Anonymous works, I don't have to be afraid to be up here. This is about God. And God has me in the palm of His hand, and I know that. At the end of it, then there's a thing called a sex inventory. Now, that sounded interesting, only because I hadn't had much. What I found out, it says, are your relationships selfish or not? And everything was. You know, I took the relationships that I had in my life and they were all selfish. And then it asks this question about, did you unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Yeah. Up until about the fifth or sixth inventory, and then it hit me like somebody dropped a truck on me. Okay? Did you unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Yeah. Yeah, I sure did. That was the way I knew how to have a relationship. Those were my tools of the trade. When I got in a relationship with this lady, I never wanted her to get a clear look at me. I mean, if she ever got both feet on the ground, got a look at me, she'd be out there quicker than you go whistle. And so I think if you always keep them off, you know, a little off center, maybe they'll hang around and they'll be curious about who you really are, and maybe they'll never find out. And so I used jealousy, even after I was married. Come home drunk. Where have you been? Out. Who you been with? Just a bunch of people. What's that stuff on your shirt? Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to bed. Or suspicion. You smell like perfume. What's going on? You know, we were dancing in a bar. What went on? Nothing. It's 4 o'clock in the morning. Nothing. Bitterness. You don't like it? I think you're a bitch. Hey, there's no anchor on your ass. You don't like it? Get out of here. That's a hell of a way to have a relationship. You know, I was 12 years sober and found out that I knew absolutely nothing about how to have a relationship. Now, how do you put that in your ego? All right? I mean, I'm sitting there. I got divorced when I was 8 years sober. And I'm sitting there, and then this lady comes along, and I'm thinking, that's the lady I'd like to spend the rest of my life with. And I didn't have a clue about how to have a relationship with her. I had to learn. And one of the hardest things that I had to learn was how to communicate. I didn't want to talk about it. You know, my idea of a relationship is, screw it, I'm out of here. That's the whole deal. I don't like it, I'm gone. And I had to sit down face to face with this woman and say, what you did really hurt me. Ugh. Or, I don't know what's going on here, but we seem to be at odds, and I think we need to sit down and talk about it. Somebody told me, they said, Olson, you always got one foot out the door. Okay? Why don't you get both feet in the door and close it? And see if it works. And I went to my wife and I told her that. I said, because I married this lady. I went in there and I said, Lori, I want to spend the rest of my life with you. I know we're going to have difficulties. But if we have them, I want to be able to sit down face to face with you, even if I'm driven to do that. And I want to work it out. And I'm in this relationship for the duration. I'm here for good, and I will not run away. And that's tough. And it works. When I was a kid, I used to, I wasn't really connected anywhere. Never didn't have a sense of family or anything, and I used to sit down on this river by this lake, and there's a lot of that around Wisconsin, and I would watch these people out in boats, you know, with families, and I used to dream about what I wanted to be. And I had this picture in my mind that I wanted to be married to this just wonderful woman that was beautiful and kept a nice big clean house and had a couple of sons and maybe a hunting dog and a fast car. Maybe own my own company one day. Maybe I really could be a success. And I sat there and I would think about that. And you know, as I got older and I started drinking, I used to think about that too. And the more I drank, the less I understood I could ever have that. I just couldn't. I just couldn't have it. Because the bottle was the only thing I was ever going to be attached to, and it took everything that I had. When I got done with my inventory, I put this, we call it take it to the grave stuff. I don't know what you call it. You know what it is? It's usually about sex. And it's something you don't want to ever tell anybody. Okay? It's really funny because I've heard an awful lot of fifth steps. It's after about the first five, nothing's different. Okay? So if you go in there and you're talking to somebody about doing your fifth step, Tell him the worst stuff first. Get it out of the way so you can have fun with your fifth step. So anyway, I had this really terrible stuff on the end, and then I went to my sponsor, and he's the only guy I ever let in, because I'm kind of a loner. And I sat down and I said, well, here it is, and I'd read him this whole inventory. And I expected him after I was done to jump up and say, you are terrible. I don't want to be around you anymore. I don't want you anywhere near me. Just stay away. And what he did was he put his arms around me, another man. And he said, I love you and I'm so glad you did it. So I followed the directions and I went home. It says, taking the book down from the shelf, we reviewed the first five proposals. So I put the book up on the shelf and took it down and reviewed the first five proposals. Hey, I don't want to miss anything. This is my life we're messing with here. To see if the work was solid. And then I asked God for the willingness to be rid of those things which had kept me from him. And then I said the seven-step prayer, the one about God, I am now ready that you have all of me, good and bad. And I was willing that he took everything. He didn't. He took some of it, and he's taken some of it. And some of it I may have to just keep working on. But I know it's God that makes the decision. I spent an hour considering it. Considering about those things that kept me from God. You know what the best description in the book about an alcoholic, like someone in this room who's been sober for a while that drinks again? It talks about resentments and fear. And it says, when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns, and we drink again. And for us to drink is to die. That's how we drink again. The insanity returns. And the insanity returns because I'm providing safe harbor to selfishness and dishonesty and resentment and fear. Let me give you just one other thing. I hate to be scattered here, but let me give you one other thing to consider before I forget it. The book says that we can find God deep down within all of us. Okay? Think about that. The reason why is because maybe God's inside trying to get out. The book says that God can be obscured by calamity and all sorts of things. But the truth is that if I'm trying to live a spiritual life, maybe we will peel the onion enough so God's light can shine out from us and we can be an example to other people. And if we're living a spiritual life, that's what happens. Some people shine. They really do. There is light coming from people. And they are people who have the door open. And God comes out of them. I made a list. The book says, make a list of all the people we have harmed, become willing to make amends to it. The next line in the book is a very interesting one. It says, we did it when we took inventory. Right? Most of my amends were already in my inventory. So I added a few to it, and then I took them to my sponsor because he insisted that I go to him and tell him precisely what the harm was before I got in front of anybody. So I wrote down, I had all these people written down and how I felt I had harmed them and who I thought I should go see and who I shouldn't go see because I thought it would cause more harm. And the one person that we really had some disagreement about was my father. I hated him. I said I never did anything to him. I mean, he took off when I was an infant. He'd show up, beat me up, drunk, then he'd go again. And he said, didn't he ever really try and touch you? And I said, once a year he'd call me on my birthday, and he was always drunk. Couldn't hardly even make sense out of what he was saying. And he said, but he was trying to talk to you, wasn't he? Because you were his son. And I said, yeah. And he said, what'd you do? And I say, I'd hang up on him. And he said, well, don't you see that even through his alcoholism, he was trying to touch you? And he said, you ought to understand that. I want you to go make amends to him for not letting him near when all he wanted to do was touch you." I went, "Well, I don't know about that." And he said, "Get in your car and drive to Wisconsin and do it." So I did. I went to Wisconsin, went into the Grand Army home. He was sitting in a wheelchair, and I walked up to him, hadn't seen him in 10, 15 years. And I said, "Hi, I'm your son, Bob." Now, he was not supposed to be capable of understanding anything at that point. And he brightened up. And I said, "I need to talk to you." And I wheeled him over into this little room, and we sat down, and I said, "I'm an alcoholic." And he became very sad. And I said, "I've found an answer in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And part of that program is to come to you and try and repair the damage that I've done. I regret having done that, and I'm willing to do anything to balance the books. I don't have to drink anymore, and my life has changed." And he became very excited, very excited. And not too long after that, he was not capable of understanding, but I know that he was then. I owed a lot of money, didn't own anything, didn't have a car, didn't have a house, barely had the clothes on my back. I asked my uncle, who was a banker, I said, "Take a look at this, I've written down all my debts and all the people I owe money to, how do I get out from under this?" He said, "It's very simple. You start paying now and you pay until it's paid." Whoa. I said, "I owe $14,000. This is in 1973. And he said, "That's what you do." And so about 30% of everything I made for the next 2.5 years went out. Hardly ever went anywhere. Hardly went to movies, almost never went to dinner. And then one day, they were having a boat show in Denver. I still owed $2,500 on my amends, and I just couldn't wait any longer, because I've always been so fascinated by boats, and I went down to the place where they were having the show, and I was walking around in there, and the Bassmasters had a raffle on this really neat-looking bass boat, and I had 3 tickets in my hand. I was looking at them, and I went, "Well, I wonder how that happened," and they had $10 of my money. And I thought, that's the dumbest damn thing I ever did. I don't even remember doing it. And the next day they called me up and told me I won the boat. And see, I had these 2 little boys. And they were much higher than about that, not as high as this podium. And they were with me, and they went down, and they're jumping around in the boat and going, "Dad, is this our boat? Do we get to take this home? Isn't this neat?" And I went to the Rebel Bass Boat dealer, and I said, "How much is that boat worth?" And he said, $2,400 wholesale. This Texan came up to me and said, "You want to sell it?" And I said, "For how much?" And he said, $2,500. "What do you do? Pay off your amends? Take the boat home and hope you make enough money to pay your amends? What do you do?" I told my kids we couldn't have the boat. And this Texan gave me $25 $100 bills, and I was clear for the first time in my adult life. See, the funny thing about that was I had been down at York Street, which is kind of the mother house in Denver, bragging to everybody what a big goddamn deal I was, how important I was, and what a wonderful job I had done in paying my amends, and how I had done the whole deal. And all of a sudden this big hand came out of the sky with $2,500 in it and said, "Who?" Up until a few years ago, I was the guy that sold most of the toasters to the savings and loans. Now, I have to tell you this from a perspective of being sober for a while. About 5 years ago, when the wheels came off of that industry, they all quit buying that. And they left me with almost $1 million worth of merchandise and no place to go. And as a result of that, my business failed, and I wound up owing $250,000. On the hook. And I'm thinking, whoa. I've been sober for 13 years. This isn't supposed to be happening to me. A year and a half later, it was paid off. $250,000. I don't know where it came from. I just went to work every day. Started a little printing company. It's the biggest one in Denver now. I went to my sponsor and I said, Don, it took 3 years for God to pay off $14,000. How do you figure he paid off $250,000 in a year and a half? And he said, what's the problem? And I said, how do you explain that? He said, no big deal, Bob. God's got all the money he needs. Ten is about continuing to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, fear. When we see it, we ask God to remove it at once, or we ask Him at once to remove it, talk to somebody about it, and then resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. That's the exercise, and it works. Okay? The trick is resolutely turning our thoughts, because that means we're in selfishness or dishonesty or resentment or fear, and we're turned in. And the trick is being able to turn out, and we can turn out by thinking of another alcoholic. We can always tell when people are really into the 10th step because you get a lot of calls. They go, I'm doing some resentment or I'm doing some fear or whatever. And 11 is about discipline. It's about what you do in the morning. You get up and say, God, please keep my day free from selfish, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. Please give me intuitive thoughts or decisions. I pray for all the people that I feel like I ought to pray for, and I ask God to show me through the day what my next step is to be in. Help me with the problems. It says I have to maintain some attitudes through the day. Thy will, not mine, be done. And I'm not running the show anymore. And it says I got to do some things when I go to bed at night. I need to review my day, see if I've taken more out than I've added. See if I need to see if I owe amends to anybody. I need to pause when I'm agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. Now, most of us equate step 12 with carrying the message, this kind of stuff, or one-on-one, or whatever. But you know, the more important show of 12 is, can you practice these principles in all your affairs? Do I just do this here? What happens when I get home? Am I growing in understanding and effectiveness? Do my kids love me? Let me tell you about my life today. I live in a nice, clean house. I have three sons, 27, 23, and 3. My wife is pregnant with twin boys. Don't ever ask it for anything unless you want a lot of it. I'm 53 years old. Well, you think it falls off when you're 50? Just a little plug for the geriatric set here. You can tell I'm the spiritual speaker. I have the respect of my peers, both in Alcoholics Anonymous and in business. I love my wife very much, and she loves me. And my three sons love me. I have everything I've ever wanted. I never could have gotten this. I couldn't have dreamed up something this good. And I didn't get it. It was just given to me. And I believe that it was given to me because God will give us whatever we want as long as we can handle it. As long as we just practice the simple program. You know, all I've done is just worked the 12 steps for 18 years. And my life has gotten together better so gradually that most of the time I can't even see it. But over the 18 years, my life has become so significantly better than anything that I have ever experienced that I cannot believe where I am today. If there is anything that I wish for you, it is everything that I have, and I would give it to you. This really works. If there are people in your AA community who don't do the steps and live on fear and fellowship, tell them that these things work. There are 12 steps in this book for a reason. They're there to work. They're there to get us closer to God, and God can do for us what we can't do for ourselves. Thank you very much.